Fine. So the last 2 weeks, we've been dealing with the question of the extent to which poskim paskin on mitzvahs. We dealt with the theory 2 weeks ago, last week, or three times ago. Last time, we dealt with how that plays itself out on the personal level and the empirical level, right, in medical issues. So this week, what I want to do is I want to use the sort of machlokot that arose over the land for peace issues, right, whether you can give back parts of Eretz Yisrael in an attempt to achieve peace or for other necessary goals, and the machlokot that arose around that. We're going to quickly go through the main halachic issues and then focus more on the epistemic issues that we've been talking about the last 2 weeks. Okay. So the main halachic issues. Let's set up the mitzvos, right? The first the mitzvos that are involved. Right? So the Gemara and Sanhedrin, Daf Chof and Vezet, V'chein Hayu Rehuda Omer, Shalosh mitzvos Nistav Yisrael B'chinisas and L'aretz, L'hamid L'melech, L'hachar Zara Shalom Malek, V'livinoz L'hamid Beis HaBachir. Right? There were three mitzvos when we came into Eretz Yisrael to have a king, destroy a Malek, and build the Beis HaBechira, right? So, now that's the sort of the first Gemara of what happened when we came to Israel, right? Part of it is destroying Amalek, is part of the wars. And obviously also was Kibosh Haaretz with the Sheva Amim itself, but that was part of the Knesset Haaretz itself. The question is to what extent, you know, Knesset Haaretz, Kibosh Haaretz, etc. itself is a mitzvah. So famously the Ramban says, in the mitzvah, the Sheikh Chasa Asin on his Hagos on the Sefer Mitzvos, the Mitzvah of Yitzchak and Savani Loresh is Aretz Asher Nasana Kelis Barach V'Salela V'Sin La'Avram L'Yitzchak L'Yakov. There's a Mitzvah Asay De Araisa to inherit the land. V'Lo Nezva V'Yadu L'Sinim and Omos O L'Shmama V'Amru Lahem V'Rashim Zarez V'Shav Tem Ba K'Nisadi L'Chem Es Aretz Loresh Zosa V'Nes Nachal Tem Es Aretz. V'nichbal kazan yan b'mitzvah zum kamer achirim. This chiyuv is mentioned many places. Bo reshu es aratesh and nishbat lavozichem. Who parado salahem b'mitzvah zu kula b'kulam mitzarera. And the Torah delineates exactly the borders of this land that you have to conquer. Kamo sha'amar uvo aram amari v'kol shchina barava b'harish v'ilav v'negev v'chof hayam v'gomer. Shlo yanicha mimenu makom. So what is the mitzvah? The mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz is not just the is to conquer all of the land, not leave any of it. Right? Is it shizu mitzvah? And what's the proof this is a mitzvah? From the miraglim that said alei reish, right? Go up and conquer it. Kasher diber Hashem alkecha lecha al tirav al teichatz ve'od amar shloach Hashem eschem mikadesh barnei lemar alu reshu es aretz asher nasati lechem kasher lo avu la'alos b'mamar hazeh. When the Jews didn't want to go in, God says, you rebelled against me, you didn't believe in me. So that tells you that Eretz Yisrael is not just a promise, but it's a mitzvah. And this, conquering Eretz Yisrael, is what we call a chemes mitzvah, a battle, which is a commandment, right? A commanded battle. The Gemara in Sota says explicitly, according to everybody, the war of Yeshua, the war of conquest, was an obligation. And David's wars to expand the borders were only divrei hakol rishos v'lashon sifrei. Now this is the important part, right? So everyone agrees that there was a commandment to conquer Eretz Yisrael in the beginning. But what's unclear from the Pesukim? Whether the mitzvah continued, right? There's clearly a command to conquer it originally, but is that a continuous mitzvah? So the Ramban famously holds, "Ve'al tishtabesh v'domar ki mitzvah zosi mitzvah milchemes shiva amamin shenitzabu v'n ezbam b'tanayim yidu'im aval aretz lo naniach osam b'yadam v'lo b'yad zelos haminumos b'dormin adoros." I don't think. Sorry, I skipped one, didn't I? Yes. Shesavu la'avdam shnemar acharem tachremim. Don't think that the mitzvah is only the seven nations. Eina davar kain. Sha'anu nistavinu la'arogomos ha'hem be'ilach ha'mamimanu. Because what's his proof? What are we supposed to do to the seven nations? Just like Amalek, we're supposed to annihilate them. We're supposed to get rid of them. We're supposed to kill them. But if they want to have peace, then we can, right? The Ramban thinks you can have peace with them. It's not quite Amalek, right? They have the option of peace. But what can't we do? We can't leave them power, right? There's two options. Either we kill them or they make peace with us and they become subordinate. Or they should run away. Kamram Hagir Gashi Panava Halachlo, right? Like the Gir Gashi left, according to Divrei Yame. And Asalam Gadish Barakar Sova Kartsam Zuafriki. And Savino Nachno Lavo Baris Vachbosh Midot Lahoshiv Bash of Tainu. Vechain Acharech Ichri. Sanu as Amim and his Karim Rotsu Achar Kash of Tainu Lazov as Aris. Boslam is Eretz Shinar, Eretz Ashur's Lot, Samana goes Inam Rashain. Right? And right, once we, even after we destroy them, we can then go and pick a different country. Because we're chayev to remain there and continuously make sure that we've conquered it and to dwell in it. And the mitzvah is through conquest. They say, and then the Gemara says, why did David conquer Syria? Right? And it didn't, and it doesn't get the mitzvahs of Tlis Baretz. Amru David, Asa Shalok Hadara, Hadara Amru Misha Tich Bishu, Eretz Yisrael Ti Rashan Lech Bosh Chutz Laretz, Vulo Asa Kain. So the Gemara says, the reason that Syria didn't get Kedusha is because David did it out of order. He should have conquered Eretz Yisrael and then Syria. He did Syria before finishing Tzrael Arein, it's Savena B'Kibush B'Chol Adoros. But what does that tell you? And this is finally his proof, that the mitzvah of Kibush continued through the time of David. So it obviously wasn't just a mitzvah on the original generation, because David is already being critiqued for not for conquering anything besides for Eretz Yisrael. It's clear that constantly, whenever there's a part of Eretz Yisrael that needs to be conquered, you have to conquer it. And then he goes on, and this is the mitzvah that Chachamim praise about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, etc., etc. Okay, so the first question that comes up in the context of land for peace is, is there a mitzvah of Kibush and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? So most of the shitas that will argue in favor will note this Ramban and say that the mitzvah of Kibush is b'chol adoros. And therefore, right, there's at least a chiyuv to attempt to hold on to the land. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean automatically that land for peace is usher. It just means that now you have to justify it, right? Of course, if you thought on the flip side that there was no chiyuv at all to live in Eretz Yisrael b'zman hazeh, then there would be no problem of giving up Eretz Yisrael. Now, who held that?
The Megillah Esther.
Before that, I mean, the Megillah Esther is trying to figure out what the Rambam holds, but right in the Balayat, right in the Rishonim. So Reb Chaim Katz. Right, it's based. So you skip for a second, right? Tosfos, this is in Ksubos Kuf Yud. Who Omer Lalos Einanog Bizman Hazet? Right, the mitzvah to make Aliyah doesn't apply nowadays. Dikat Sakon is Drachem because it's dangerous. Why Omer Rabbeinu Chayim? The Achshav Ein Mitzvah Lozer Eretz Yisrael Kish Kamitz is Lose Baris Become Aunchin Einan Chon Lizar Behem Velamad Aleihem. What?
Sorry.
What did you say?
The only reason is because it's dangerous.
No, so that's the first one. That's why you don't have to make Aliyah. And Reb Chaim Kohn goes farther and says, no, there's no mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael because the mitzvahs of Tlus Baretz aren't chal. Right? So the Ramban, right? The basic lumdus here, the Ramban thinks the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is independent of the mitzvahs of Tlus Baretz, and Reb Chaim Katz thinks it's not. Bizman hazeh, especially according to the Ramban, Trumos is derabanan, right? Chala. Right, because there's no bias kulchem, right? That's really a pasuk by Yichala, but Rambam expands it to Truma. Shemitah and Yovel doesn't apply without bias kulchem. Right, so the mitzvahs don't apply. So the mitzvahs don't apply, then the mitzvah doesn't apply at all. Right, he also says it's dangerous, you don't have to go up. Right, if this was a shiur on mitzvah, so I would get into more details, but right, suffice it to say that the Ramban thinks that there's a continuous mitzvah to conquer and live in Eretz Yisrael, and Rabbeinu Chaim Katz quoted in Tosfos thinks that is not the case. Okay, those are sort of the two extremes. If you go back, there's obviously the even more extreme shita, which is not is it a mitzvah or not a mitzvah? But the shita, which is made famous by Satmar, and basically rejected by everybody else, which is it's usher to conquer, not usher to live. It's much to live. It's usher to conquer, based on what? Shalshua. So that's the Gemara. Before, when we buy the Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Chanina, the Amar Shalshua, Shalom Lama, Acha Shal Yaalu Yisrael Becholma. Yeah.
What exactly is Biyat Kulcham?
A rove of Klal Yisrael living in Eretz Yisrael.
Right, so it's not a mitzvah to live in Israel until rove of Am Yisrael live in Israel. But if it's not a mitzvah to live in Israel until rove, then why would people move to Israel if it's not a mitzvah and then you never have a rove?
It's a value, isn't it?
The value, probably.
I guess.
You want to bring it to Chiyuv? Right,
or if you went to Bnei Akiva,
I'm saying it's not a. You're not again, right? You're not chayev to wear a four cornered garment. Why do you wear a four cornered garment? Right, to be mekayem mitzvah. You think, right? It's not a. Right, we don't try to avoid it. Right, you don't. Right, we don't think that just because something's not chiyuvi, you don't have to do it or you shouldn't do it. So the shalosh shvuos are acha shel yad yisrael b'chama. V'acha sheishvi hakadosh baruch hu yisrael shel yimra du ba'umos olam. The other is that we promise that we won't rebel against the nations of the world. And the other is that the nations of the world should not be mishabed us. Okay, so the first two halachic issues on the table. First is it a mitzvah or not a mitzvah? Bizman has that, right? Therefore, if we're going to give back land, right, are we... In some way, do we have to justify negating a mitzvah? Right, the Ramban is very clear that if it's a mitzvah, it's to conquer every part of the land, right? Fill all the gvulos. Or it's not a mitzvah, in which case, at the moment, we don't have to worry about it. The second question, is it in fact usher to conquer? Then obviously, right, on the national level, there would be no problem of giving back land, so to speak, on a sovereign level, because we're not supposed to be sovereign. We'll get to another halachic problem in a minute, but at least on the sovereignty level, that's not a problem, right? That is like the, if you take the Sanra position of the Shalosh Shvuos, that's what Ya'alu Yisrael B'chomah means, right? Obviously, that would mitigate the land for peace issues. That, of course, Rove Rubo Poskim rejected for a multiple of reasons. For example, right, why do people reject the Shalosh Shvuos argument?
Going on, not keeping up there, under the deal.
Right, so either you take the Gemara literally halachically, but you think it's a contingent commitment, right? That if they aren't, if they don't, torture us too much, then we won't be ola b'chama. And since they didn't keep up their part of the bargain, we didn't. Or you just say the Gemara is agadic and not halachic. Or you say, right, which like I think Rav Chanan said this. Some of the right poskim said this. Right when during the time of the precursors to the state, that what's the second part of the Shal Shuos? Shal Yimr Du B'Mazol won't rebel against the nations of the world, but if the UN would vote it into existence, right, at that moment they would have given us sovereignty and that would be it, right? It wouldn't be merit. So those are just three ways of getting around it. But that's halachic issue number two. Halachic issue number three is when we say land for peace, right, what is the most straightforward halachic argument in favor of giving up land for peace? It
saves lives.
It saves lives. So the third question we have to ask is, well, is that a good justification? It normally is, but is it in the case of Yeshiva Yisrael? So that's not obvious because...
On a halachic level.
We'll get to the Matthias in a moment, which is where we're going to come to, but first I want to get the halachic issues on the table. And this is, everyone quotes a famous Minchas Chinuch, the Mitzvah Tav Chaf Hei, where he asks the basic question, then we'll read it inside. What mitzvah in the Torah always leads to cases of Sakandas Nefashas?
Melchama.
War, right? If Pikuach Nefesh is Docha Kol Mitzvah Samaritas B'Torah, then how could the Torah ever command war? Isn't war dangerous? Right? So Minchas Chinuch just says, look, V'noag mitzvah zu b'chol ish Yisraeli, Henan Hashem v'na Hashem, G'vor b'shas, Chemetz mitzvah, Fiyol kal mi'chubad v'cholei. Because of Rabbi Mechaber, over al zeh, over, Avodah Zarah, Ubal, Yadav, Yachal, Har, Gom, B'li, Shistakim, Dar, Cholei, V'tzarach Iyun, War is dangerous, and the Torah doesn't rely on Nisim, which means the fact that the Torah told you to go to Mechametz Mitzvah means that Pikuach Nefesh doesn't apply in time of war. It just doesn't. Period. And therefore, it's a mitzvah to fight, even if you're going to be put in danger. So the fourth halacha issue now, the next halacha issue they have to deal with is, to what extent is Pikuach Nefesh even an argument in the context of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, right? Now, in order to get to this point, you have to assume what? Well, let's follow the arguments, right? It has to be a Mechametz Mitzvah. Now, how would it be a Mechametz Mitzvah? What is qualified as a Mechametz Mitzvah? Mechametz Kibush. Right, so the easiest way to get to the Minchas Chinuch, you have to assume two things. You have to assume the Minchas Chinuch is right, and the Ramban is right, right? And then you might come to the argument that you can't give up land even to save lives because it's a subset of mitzvahs kibush. Now, there are other milchamos mitzvahs, such as Lahatzil Yisrael Miyatzar, right, to save Jews from danger, which may mean that you could hold of the Minchas Chinuch even if you don't hold of the Ramban, right, that saving Jews who practically live here makes it a milchamos mitzvah. But that
would not be solved.
Right, but that wouldn't be a fundamental argument, right? Because then you'd have to make the argument that it saves more lives. Or then, yeah.
But is he saying that kibush itself is the mitzvah?
The mechametz kibush is the mitzvah. Right, the mitzvah of mechametz mitzvah, any mechametz mitzvah is doch pikuach nefesh.
Okay, but like keeping the land would also be considered part of that.
I mean, again, you have to take two assumptions. You have to assume that he would agree with the Ramban. You'd have to assume the Ramban and the Minchas Chinuch to get Bizman Hazeh. Right? To say that the mitzvah of Milchama or Kibbutz is continual and that Minchas Chinuch is right. Now, the last issue is, even if none of this is true, right, even if, let's say, we're not supposed to have sovereignty, etc., you know, etc., etc., there still is a mitzvah pratit, which may make it usur to give land back, and that is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Chav that says, Damar Kral lo sichaneim, right, don't, you know, show them favor. So the first drasha there is, lo titin lahem chanaya bikarka. Then the Gemara raises two other things that it means. And the Gemara in the end says, shma mina kulu, right? That there are two other Yisurim, but for our purposes, the most important is the first one, is lo titin lahem chanaya bikarka. In addition to the sovereign national question, right, of kibush, not kibush, there's also an isur d'araisa to give land to, in Eretz Yisrael, to non-Jews. Isur d'araisa.
Isn't that just for the Shavuot?
What?
Isn't that just for the Shavuot?
Ah, so you have to assume that that's for the Shavuot, right? Or alternatively, of Devo Dezara, right? And also, even if that's not true, you'd have to assume it's not true, right? For land for peace, you'd have to assume this would be Docha Pikuach Nefesh, which is not at all obvious. The big rent machlokot, you know, here, yes, you have to assume a very specific read that it's for not just the Shavuot, which is not obvious.
It's part of the Pasuk.
What?
Shout out to Pasuk.
No, I'm saying that it's... Which is part of the Pasuk?
Only Shavuot.
Yeah, I said saying that it's not Shavuot and it's not Pasuk. Yeah. I mean, expanding it is very... I mean, famously, Rav Shmuel Eliyahu expanded it, and this was a big machlokas, and Rav Aaron fought him, and Rav Ariel fought him. But fine. And also, it's not clear rent would even fall into that. Like, right? Rent, selling, whatever. But that's another story. Okay. So, if we want to summarize the halachic issues that are going to be dealt with, right? So these are the relevant questions, right? The first question is there a mitzvah of kibush Eretz Yisrael bizman hazeh? Ramban says yes. The Reb Chaim Katz says no. Right? So if there isn't, then postures there's no problem sort of on the national level, on the sovereign level, to give back land if it'll save lives, right? There's no svara to say that it's usur. If you're holding a Ramban, then we have to go to a second level question. Second halachic issue is, right, even more extreme, is it usur for us to hold sovereignty? In which case, obviously, we could give back land. We're not even supposed to have sovereignty over it. That's the Shalosh Shvuos argument, which we noted just three ways of potentially negating that. The Gemara is only agadic. the nations of the world agreed to it in the UN vote, or the nations of the world did torment us, and therefore the shuls were broken. Next halachic issue is, even if you assume that there is a mitzvah of kibush, is it doche pikuach nevesh? The Minchas Chinuch assumes it is, so you have to assume both the Ramban and the Minchas Chinuch. And then the next question is not on the sovereign level, but on the individual level, even if there's no sort of national mitzvah to keep the land, is there an isra for us to give them the land, which is the possibility of lo sechanim? And then, in order to say it's asr, yes, you have to assume that lo sechanim means that it applies even to not Shavam men, or not Avodei Avodah Zarah, which usually when we're talking about land for beasts, talking Muslims, and Muslims are not Avodei Avodah Zarah. So you would have to assume that's the case. And even if that weren't the case, right, even if it were Asr, you'd have to come up with some argument that that is Doche, Pikuach Nefesh. Now, taking a few halachic arguments here, right, depending on how you come out and the different permutations of this, the big question you have to answer is, one, where do you stand on the halachic issues? But the second issue is, where do you stand on the Matzias issues? Because let's just say you assume that Pikuach Nefesh will be Doched, and we'll get to why you would think that even if you held like Minchas Chinuch. Or you thought that it was Lo Sechanim, but Pikuach Nefesh Doched Lo Sechanim. You'd still have to figure out, right, is there Pikuach Nefesh? And right, we saw already last week, even in medical shaylos, it's very difficult to figure out how exactly you determine all these things, Kal v'chomer on a national level. Especially since, right, it's mostly predictive, right? We're playing political games here, and we're trying to figure out what is going to happen in the future. So those are the halachic issues that are raised in the discussion, okay? And we'll see it as we go through. I don't want to get bogged down in the specifics since I'm focused on sort of one of the other issues. But we'll see as we go through. The last thing, and this is a point that I think apparently the Rav made, and Rav Shechter quotes it, we actually have a precedent in the Gemara for quote-unquote land for peace, which is, since you can just follow my next source, is Rabbi Yochanan in or the Gemara in Gittin, the Churban Gemaras, right, that Rabbi Yochanan went to, right, what did he do? He went to the Caesar, and what did he say? He said, I'll give you three wishes, right, what does he say? So then the Gemara said, right, so Rabbi Kiva said, right, it was stupid, should have asked for Yerushalayim. The second day, right, so the first day it says, look, he really was wrong, he should have asked for Yerushalayim. But, you know, God confused him. Second day, it says, no, Rabbi Yochanan actually had a svara, which was, he thought if he asked Yerushalayim, he'd get nothing. So it's not an exact parallel, but what is it clear? That the Gemara is assuming that he at least could have tried to get Yerushalayim, right? And he gave it up for other things, right? He gave it up, he said, look, I'll take what I can get. I'll take Yavnev Chachameha and actively give up in Yerushalayim. In Chanami, he might not have gotten it, but he didn't even have to try. Right? He was allowed to make the choice not to try to get Yerushalayim to make sure that if it didn't work out, they would at least have Yavnev Chachameha. Right? So there is a, right, you see there is some sort of cheshbon going on in this Gemara, right? Should he have attempted to get Yerushalayim or not? There's both a Metzius Machlok is going on, would it have worked? And there's also a values argument is, should he have tried when he's not sure it would have worked, or should he, you know, be willing to settle for something to make sure that there would be a Sheirus Upleita, even if they didn't get Yerushalayim, okay? So those are the halachic issues to keep in mind. Okay. So, now, let's see, let's go to Rav Shechter's article, okay? The next source. Rav Shechter is now commenting on this Gemara in Rabbi Yochanan. Right, so does that Gemara, where it's clear that Rabbi Yochanan sort of gives up on trying to get Yerushalayim in order to save Yavnei Chachamah, does that act, is that a potential source for the notion that under certain circumstances we're allowed to give up for land for peace. So here I think Rashi is correct that probably not. And he says, surface examination of the two situations, however, reveal that they bear no basis for comparison. Whereas the Jews' revolt against the Romans was obviously doomed to failure, the war of the Israeli army today against the Arab insurgency is being conducted with moderate success. Right? It could just be that the only precedent we have in the Gemara is where, what does the Gemara say? Riochanan thought he would get nothing. Right? So, okay, when you're not going to get nothing, so you don't have to try for nothing. Right? And you can settle with taking Yavne v'chachlamea. But if the Israeli army were to fight, it's not obvious we would lose. Right? It might make more peace. It might or might not. But, you know, it's clear that we can, at some level, handle and repel attacks, and we're usually at least moderately successful, even if we have losses. So the Sanhedrin under Yochanan Zakkai act directly by surrendering, for there is no mitzvah to stick out a losing battle. This is quite dissimilar to the present situation in Israel. Thus, it may be argued that it is incumbent upon them to fight to the victorious finish, despite the possible tragic losses that may incur. We have to examine, right, so Shechter, at this point, all he says is that the Rabbi Yochanan Gemara doesn't prove anything. It just says that there's no chiyuv when it's a losing battle. Right, when we can't possibly win. But if we possibly win, we have no source in the Gemara whether we can give up land for peace. But then what, which brings us back to what question? The empirical question, right? What are the chances of success? We have to examine very carefully the premise that Israel can ultimately succeed in its military struggle with the Arabs. Perhaps, despite the fact the Israeli army succeeding in retaining the territories it's held since 1967 and enforcing tenuous order there, the toll that the current situation is exacting from the nation's morale and from its standard of living might warrant our defining Israel's current status as winning the battle but losing the war. If in truth Israel's in a losing position, then perhaps a land for peace negotiation, assuming that Israel were assured they would thereby achieve a real lasting peace, again, part of the Matthias question here, would be in order. Indeed, Israel's current situation must be evaluated to determine whether it is presently engaged in a winning battle. I copied this from, you know, a PDF, so some of these got a little mixed up. Or, God forbid, a losing one, or perhaps a stalemate. Resolution of this question will determine whether Israel is halakhically mandated to fight or alternatively required to withdraw from the struggle. So, Rav Shachter makes sort of the straightforward argument. And this might even be true for the Ramban, right, and the Minchas Chinuch, right, is that the Gemara tells us that a losing battle, right, you're allowed to give up and settle for less. Now, that may be true for the Ramban, right, because the Ramban could say, look, you're chayev to conquer all of Eretz Yisrael, but if you're not going to be able to anyways, right, it's just impossible at the moment, so maybe you can trade land for peace for a better situation in the interim. Even the Minchas Chinuch says, look, you have to risk your life for war, but he doesn't necessarily say you have to risk your life for a losing battle. Right? He just says if you're going to win, there's still Pikuach Nefesh, or you have a chance at winning. So Shechter notes that the real question, and this might even negate all the halachic issues we've been talking about until now, is the battle winnable or not? And if it's not winnable, then perhaps even according to the Ramban, even according to the Minchas Chinuch, it would be justifiable to simply pull out so that we're not fighting a losing battle.
What do you mean by the battle?
Battle, right? He said battle war. Like,
the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Basically, I mean, our survival.
What year did he write this in?
In the 90s, I think. I think it's before the last. It's not, this wasn't, this is before disengagement. I think this was after the Begin one.
So before the Intifada, though.
I think it was after Begin, before, like, some, I think it was the 90s, but I have to look at the exact date.
It's just that, it sounds like, from what he's saying, that Israel is losing the battle back then, but, like, I think nowadays, I mean,
losing the battle in the sense that it's a war, some level of war of attrition, but, I mean.
Yeah, I'm just curious what he would say nowadays, if he would say the same thing.
Well, you'll see in a second, he's not saying anything. Right? He's saying it theoretical. He's putting a hypothetical. Right? So far, we've listed a series of halakhic questions. Now he's adding another level. Even if all those were true, it may be that if we were fighting a losing battle, right, then we would be allowed to give up land if that was the best way to win in the interim. Yes?
Uh-huh.
And this is why I wanted to read Rashachar's article, because Rashachar will connect us to last week. But Rashachar said, what's the problem? And we noted this last week. Right? There's a problem in general. Who makes the mitzvahs? Assessments that halacha is based on. And we noted how hard that is, even in empirical data on a personal level, right? Medical questions. Kal Vachomer ben Menoshe, Kal Vachomer, and we're dealing with a national level with political situations which are much less empirically grounded, right? It's speculation about the future. It's even sometimes speculation about the past, right? Right? Meaning there are people, most people at this point say disengagement was a bad idea because it didn't give us security, but some people thought the real threat was not security, it was demographics. And it may be that, right, you can't say whether demographics would be even more dangerous to us than the current security situation, right? If you think that demographics were, then we may have won in this engagement, right? You can't actually look back and tell conclusively, right? Because it depends. What does it even mean to win? What does it mean to lose? So that's the continuation of Schechter's article. So Israel today, winner or loser? Right? This is the question. At the end of the day, so he says, but who is authorized to make this crucial decision? To shed light on this question, let us return to the point that Sakanas Nefashos must be disregarded in waging war. Right? As you know, the first page, basically, I took Rav Schechter's halachic arguments and I spelled them out for you. Right? So he said, let's take the Minchas Chinuch. Let's assume that Sakanas Nefashos is disregarded in waging war. Is it merely in the interest of maintaining our national pride that we are prepared to sacrifice the lives of Jewish soldiers? Or is the mitzvah of waging war one for which a Jew is required to forfeit his life? In answer to this, it would appear that at the heart of our preparedness to fight for Eretz Yisrael is the fact that Israel's role today is as the national homeland, there we go, of the Jewish people. Since a nation's land is vital to its existence as a nation state, to the point that in various limited contexts, only those Jews residing in Eretz Yisrael are considered full members of Klal Yisrael, conquest by a foreign power is considered a lethal blow to the essence of the conquered nation. So now he explains, right? What does he think the Minchas Chinuch means? Right? Why is it Doche B'Koach Nefesh? Because there's two types of Koach Nefesh. There's actual B'Koach Nefesh of lives, and then there's national B'Koach Nefesh. Right? And in national B'Koach Nefesh, it's our identity as a nation state. Therefore, just as a doctor would amputate a patient's limb in order to save life, when the life of an entire nation is endangered, it is permissible to sacrifice the lives of the few for the purpose of sparing the nation at large. Right? So he thinks the svara is basically you're giving one pikuach nefesh for another, right? You can sacrifice the individuals for the pikuach nefesh of the nation. Thus the question at hand seems comparable to that of a sick individual who must decide the course of action his doctor should undertake. Right? So he said, even according to Minchas Chinuch, basically, right, follow his argument, right? And you'll see in a little bit that Rav Avraham Shapira took the Minchas Chinuch as part of his argument that you can have land for peace. But Rav Schechter is arguing against that and saying, no, even if you hold the Minchas Chinuch, why would you hold Pikuach Nevesh and Nidcha Mishum Milchama? Because it's one Pikuach Nevesh for another. But what does that presuppose? Not that you always have to give up your life for Eretz Yisrael, but what?
If it'll work.
Right, if you assume that it's just trading one Pikuach Nefesh for another, right, individual for national, then still the fundamental question is not a halachic one, it's a empirical one. Right? Are we winning? Is it going to work? Is it necessary to save the nation state? I mean, at that level, right, Rav Schechter compares it at some level to the questions we dealt with last week, the medical question. Right, so the poskim discuss the case of a patient who was fatally ill, but who could receive treatment that would prolong his life, although cause painful side effects. In such a situation, since there's no clear consensus whether going ahead with such treatment is desirable, this decision is left to the sick individual. Likewise, in the case of a nation in mortal danger, faced with a solution of dubious value, the decision on the course of action to be taken should be in the hands of the majority of those affected. So Schechter comes up with a model, a parallel to the medical shayla. And he says, well, if we go back to our question, who does he think is qualified to make mitzias arguments in halachic questions?
The chola or the doctor.
Yeah, not the posig, right? The experts in mitzias. Now the problem is, well, who is the quote-unquote doctor or the patient in a national situation, right?
Everyone.
How do you gauge everyone? So here he tries to ground it, and he says, in earlier times, right, this is the famous vort by the Rav, the Sanhedrin, or even a single accepted leader, could render such decisions on behalf of the entire tzibur. Right? The Rav family said, Sanhedrin has two roles. One is judge, as the judges, the other one is simply the representative of Klal Yisrael. As the halacha regards him as representative of the majority opinion of Klal Yisrael. However, inasmuch as there exists neither Sanhedrin nor any person or group of persons widely accepted as leaders by the Jewish nation, it seems that the only course available is to assess the majority opinion of the Jews afflicted by this malady. It should be noted that this decision is not a matter of psak halacha. Therefore, just as only the individual patient and not his rabbis may decide which form of treatment to undergo, in this case, the opinion of rabbinic leaders should carry no more weight than that of anyone else. Yet, if military experts insist that it is impossible for Israel to maintain permanent control over Judea and Samaria, then even if the opinion of the entire Israeli population were unanimously otherwise, their demand would not be heeded. Again, we draw on the medical analogy. If all medical experts agree that they are unable to prolong the life of a particular patient, even the patient insists they receive a specific form of treatment, his request would be ignored. Only in a situation in which the doctors themselves admit that there are valid considerations favoring either possibility is the decision left to the patient. Therefore, in this case, in which military experts claim that it is possible to maintain control of Judea and Samaria but at the cost of a regular loss of in lives, it is for the public to decide whether the war is worth fighting. In tallying the majority opinion of Klal Yisrael, it must also be stipulated that not everyone who is Jewish is considered a member of Klal Yisrael for this purpose. Among the criteria for qualified membership is that the individual be a ma'amen, that he circumcised his sons, that he be married to a Jewess, that he believe that Eretz Yisrael is the Jewish homeland, and that he live there. Only such people may have input into the decision as to whether we are currently engaged in a winning situation or losing one. In addition, the process of seeking majority consensus is to be undertaken for the sole purpose of appraising the situation with regard to the danger which people involved feel that it poses them. Thus, one who feels that Israel is in a winning position may not allow his opinion to be colored by humanitarian or other considerations. Indeed, if it were ascertained that Israel maintains the upper hand in its current engagement, then not only is it mandatory that we continue to fight, but actually be forbidden to stop or impede the war, as will be explained. So Rav Shechter halachically basically accepts some form of the Minchas Chinuch argument, right? Ramban plus Minchas Chinuch, that there's a mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael b'zman hazeh, that includes kibush. Kibush includes the chiyuv of even risking lives, but he makes the argument that it's only risking lives because you're going to be able to save the nation. And then he says, well, which makes it fundamentally an empirical question. But then you have to figure out who decides the empirical question. So Rav Shechter basically has a two-pronged argument, which is who makes the decision. So what does he say?
People.
Yeah, but he has a two-pronged argument for it. If there's a clear expert consensus, then who makes the decision? The experts, which he says plausibly are the
generals.
The military experts, right? One could also argue the political experts, but right, the demographic issue, right? Political, military, whatever, right? If there are studim lekan ulekan and neither says machriya, then who makes it? Makes up the decision?
The people, right?
The representative of the people, which presumably is either actually national consensus or the political body. Now he thinks that it's only the people who shomer Torah mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael and etc. But we can, you know, quibble about those details. But the basic model is, right, Rav Shechter is, right, on the halachic issues, paskaling like the Ramban and the Minchas Chinuch, but reinterpreting the Minchas Chinuch to say that all the Minchas Chinuch is saying is you can't give up a winning battle just because you're going to lose lives. But that means the real question then is to figure out whether it's a winning battle. But then on the question we're trying to figure out is who gets to decide Matthias' questions, he takes a very strong opinion, which is from the Rav, right, not surprisingly. Not the rabbis, right? Then either the experts or the people, depending on whether it's a quote-unquote clear-cut situation or not, okay?
But still, I don't understand what he means by a winning or losing battle. And you can't leave that up to the experts. Like, you have to define first what a winning or losing battle
so
is.
So, he's pretty clear that he, Shachar is pretty clear that he, I mean, you can see it, right? He says, a winning situation for him is that we could continue to hold on to the land. Right, in a sense that would not cause a mortal blow to the nation. Right, he doesn't think humanitarian concerns, moral concerns, he doesn't think those are acceptable. Right, like we can't say for Shechter, it's pretty. I assume what he's like hinting at is that saying the Arabs deserve a state for him would not work. Right, I mean that's pretty clear. Right? That he wouldn't want. But for him, it sounds like anything that would be a mortal blow to the state. Now, would he include a demographic thing that if we, you know, kept Gaza, they would eventually have the majority in the state and would democratically take over the country, right? Maybe, because that would be a mortal blow to the Jewish nation state. Right? So it could be he would include something like that. I don't know. He's not 100% clear. But it's clear that what he holds is that it's something that would cause a mortal blow to the state, right? Which, he said, could be different things for different people, right? There are certain things that are obviously mortal blows, like literally killing everybody or losing total sovereignty. right? But he also seems to have middle cases where we would lose a lot of lives and would demoralize the country, and then that's not Baruch Lakan or Lakan, and then the people have to make up their mind, is this too painful that it would be a mortal blow to national morale, right? So those are the, right, you read between the lines, you can read the article and you can see he fleshes out a little bit more. Okay. Now, the rest of these makaros, and we'll go through as much as we can. I just really wanted to have you to have most of it on it. We have 22 minutes. We're not going to go through all of it. So after the disengagement in Gaza, there was a lot of machlokas in the country, whether we should support it, whether we should be Masarif Pekudah, right, whether we shouldn't listen to the orders to disengage. And the big Bali Plukta, well, really just Rav Lichtenstein and everybody else, but it got written up as a series of letters between Rav Aaron and grandson-in-law, writing on his behalf. Like, he would consult. Ram Shapiro was the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz, and would write his halakhic position. There was a back and forth. Okay?
Where is this?
This is in tradition. You can just go online. You'll see it. If you go on the tradition index, you'll find his two articles. What?
Gushfiles.
You have it in Gushfiles?
Fine. Don't tell the internet.
You can get it. It's free now.
I mean, now it's free in tradition. It's not a big deal. Wasn't it? It's not republished in one of like Leaves of Faith or something, or
it might be, but
or in the or maybe the new one, whatever it is. But it's you can get it in tradition. You can get it on the Good Trials Brownlee. Okay. Okay.
Which volume?
I should have put it. Sorry, I'll find it. I mean, you can just search it, but I'll find it. Okay. So here you'll see, right? You know, I'm not going to point out every single time, but you'll see as we go through. The halachic issues are raised. I want you to keep in mind two things. One is how does both Rav Aaron and Rav Aaron Shapira deal with the halachic issues? And two is how do they deal with the empirical issues? Okay? So, let's just start reading and we'll be skipping around here a lot. Okay? So let's first read. This is first the original ruling by Rav Shapira. Paragraph after lengthy paragraph on the way of Torah on these important matters can be written. By this time, I will give you as an answer the brief practical halachic verdict so the house of Israel will know the ways of Torah and go in the ways of its commandments. A. According to Torah law, it is completely forbidden to give land to a non-Jew due to the prohibition of Lo Sechanim. Right, so you'll see all the halachic issues we were talking about come up. And due to the nullification of this commandment to settle the land of Israel, that is incumbent upon every individual of Israel. This prohibition applies to every Jew, soldier and civilian alike, in order to take part in the evacuation of Jews from their homes, in order to give over land to non-Jews, in order that is against the religion of our holy Torah and forbidden to fulfill. Every order that is contrary to Jewish law and compels one to violate the words of the Torah holds no validity, is forbidden to fulfill, and no person has the authority to deliver it. About such instances, Rambam wrote, it goes without saying that if an order of the king nullifies a commandment, then it is not listened to. Anyone who violates this prohibition will not be exonerated. Right? His lashon is lo yinakeh, and we won't get into it, but Rav Aaron gets very annoyed at the use of lo yinakeh. Not in this world and not in the world to come. Rav Aaron Shapira is very harif. He's convinced it's Lo Sechanim, and no one can argue with him. B. In general, the prohibition of handing land over to non-Jews includes helping those engaged in the transgression. It's Lefnei Iver, right? Therefore, one must not participate in blocking the entrances to Gush Katif, etc., etc. C. A soldier or police officer that harbs the holy items of Israel and, God forbid, destroys heavenly articles and holy accoutrements, such as Torah scrolls, phylacteries, mezuzot, etc., is violating lo tason kain lashem elokeichem. Right, so you'll see this is D-E also, right? This, I think, is just thrown on for sort of linguistic flair, which is you're also destroying shuls and sifrei Torah, and, right, but it's not the heart of the issue, so I left out those. F, it is incumbent upon every Jew to do all he can to stop the transgression. Moreover, every Jew is required to protest. Of course, the use of violent means against soldiers of the IDF or the Israeli police is not permitted. And G, only great sages of the generation whose decisions are widely accepted in Israel are allowed to adjudicate difficult questions in all parts of the Torah and are allowed to render such decisions that affect all of Israel. All those who have not reached this level should abstain from rendering decisions on these issues. If he does render decisions on this matter, the Rambam called him an evil person, a fool, and haughty, and further said about him, many corpses has she made to fall, Rabim Chalal and Mibila, many are his dead. These are the small students who have not studied sufficiently and wish to aggrandize themselves before the ignoramuses and the people of their city, and they leap and sit at the head to instruct Israel, and it is they who increase conflict, and it is they, and they are the destroyers of the world who put out the light of Torah and ruin the vineyard of God. the God of legions, and it is about them that Solomon said in his wisdom, small foxes have taken hold of us, small foxes destroying the vineyards. H, those who follow the rulings of the rabbis, who have not reached the level of rendering decisions in these matters, are not categorized as inadvertent transgressors, they too will be judged. I, from the straits, in the days between the straits, Banat Mitzarim, God will hear the voice of his nation, will answer us bountifully, and out of suffering and tribulation, find for us salvation and well-being, and he will take away the shame of his nation from the whole earth because God has spoken. So his halachic argument is basically lo sechanem, right? And later on he brings them in Minchas Chanuch as well, though he didn't in his original psak, and you're destroying, you know, Sifrei Torah. And the second thing is that who gets to make the decisions?
Rabbis.
Right, that's basically the important thing here, right? Is that he thinks it's lo sechanem, which is the doraisa, and the big rabbis, not just rabbis, but big rabbis, by which he probably means
him
and people who agree with him, correct? Pashas are allowed to make this decision.
And not
though, what?
And not Rabban.
Well, see, that's the problem that they had, is that they can't, that they never successfully, right? They never have really. Well, many other people, if they don't agree with them ideologically, they sort of knock them. Rabban has, you know, is a little bit above that, right? They don't do that to him. And you'll see that even in the article, and we'll see in a moment, throughout the entire thing, Rav Aaron is referred to as Kvod Torato, right? That is the title he gets, right? The two, right?
But even so, he's still a Das Yachid.
Yes, yes.
He's not making the argument, though, that inherently we should be playing. He's just making the argument that we shouldn't be giving it to them.
We'll get to it. You'll see as it gets fleshed out, okay? So now Rav Aaron responds. Halachic ruling issued a few days ago by your eminent Torah authority has been brought to my attention. Allow me to raise several questions of clarification. It's even more beautiful in Hebrew, but you know, whatever, okay. In order to understand your position more clearly, let me preface my remarks by saying that I come not... What?
He translated this himself?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. That I come not, God forbid, to provoke, though whoever did a good job. I come not, God forbid, to provoke, nor in the role of one who feels insulted or offended, even though I disagree with you, and you're calling me not a Talmud Chacham, whatever. May heaven be my witness that were it not for the importance and urgency of the matter, many seeing as bordering both in the breach of the honor of God's name and the issues of life and death, I would have kept silent. My objective is merely to clarify positions and draw people closer together. I have some questions regarding a number of specific points, and I hope towards the end of my remarks to address several examples. By the way, what I cut out for you, but you have to read inside because it's just fun, is Rav Aaron says, how could you use lo yinakeh? Right? Like, lo yinakeh is left for the most egregious of errors, and even if people don't agree with you, right? And even if you think they're wrong, it's not lo yinakeh, right? And so, Ram Shapira's grandson, right, wrote back, I don't understand what you're writing, Kvot Torato, lo yinakeh is used in all these tshuvot, right, about this issue and that issue, and Ram responds, basically, I understand that you're good at using Bar Ilan, but I don't understand, but you clearly don't understand what I'm talking about. And like, it's a very brutal, anyways, very brutal letter here. Anyways, my primary perplexity, however, relates to the general position that characterizes the aforementioned ruling. Many of the determinations of the ruling are clear and obvious to any student. You can't steal, demolish synagogues, assist in the commission of Avera, etc., etc. But as for the relevancy of those directives to our case, however, two arguments may be raised, which to a certain degree have a common denominator. The respective values and principles divide Israeli society, regarding which there is no consensus, dividing a particular initiative as patently illegal and moral selective refusal of orders is impossible. Right? Right? Ravaran points out that all these sort of secondary issues are secondary. Right? The real issue here is it legitimate? And if you think it's not legitimate, should you go a step farther and say it's us and the IDF should refuse to do it? And here Ravaran says, what are you doing? Refusal on the right invites refusal on the left and vice versa. Right? You can't tell the IDF to refuse. You can't be Masaref Kuda. The result is a divided and disjointed army, part of which dissents and abstains from initiative in one direction, the other rejects initiative the opposite direction, right? He raises yet another halachic argument, which is rabbis butting in to these issues and telling people to be Masaref Kuda is itself Pikuach Nevesh, because it, right, breaks the coherence of the army. The damage to the unity and cohesion of the army, the readiness for mutual dedication and sacrifice is clear, and as a result, the IDF's ability to carry out its missions and its powers of deterrence are eroded. One need not be a great general or statesman to understand the possible implications. In short, one argues looking at the issue from a comprehensive, deep, and long-range perspective, and let us not forget, they warn, that Reb Chaim permitted biblically forbidden labor and Shabbat in order to save a person from imprisonment and was liable to cause his death in another 20 years. We're dealing with a concern about the loss of human life and the weakening of the state and its army. At the same time, they argue that there are military and political professionals who maintain that there is a reasonable chance that the present government's plan will save human lives, again in the long run, or that it will preserve the Jewish demographic character of the state. There's no certainty about this, but in the opinion of many competent judges, there's also no certainty in the opposite either. It is difficult to anticipate the future, and only a few days ago we read of the prophets whose visions were vain and foolish, etc., etc. The published ruling totally ignores these arguments. So now the bolded part. Thus, I come to my first question. Do you simply deny absolutely that these scenarios are possible, being convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that rightness and logic are to be found exclusively among the professionals who advised him? And if so, one asks respectfully, what is the basis for this absolute certainty? Is it an assessment of the situation, faith and trust, or God's secret revealed to those who fear him? Right? This is a very harif thing to say, right? Is it Sod Hashem L'Reyav? Right? Well, alternatively, do you agree that the danger exists, but do not suffice to tilt the balance when deciding the halacha, either because of the prohibition involved or so severe that they cannot be overridden by possible risk to life, or because the importance of preserving the integrity of the land of Israel outweighs considerations of life? In a similar context, a parallel question arises, right? Lo yinakeh, etc., etc. So Rav Aharon basically says that really, right, Rav Aharon Shapiro was conflating two issues, right? One issue is it a good idea? The second issue is, even if it will save lives, is there a halachic argument against giving land back, even if it will save lives? Right? That's really what it comes down to. And he's conflating them. Rav Aharon's calling him out for that because he's saying, right, by conflating those, you're dodging the question, which is it possible you're wrong, and what are the implications of a suffix? Yes? Yes, we're good so far? Yes? Okay. Right, then he says, lo yinakeh, fine. Now, continuing on this notion, right, that it's right, a suffix, and so continuing in the bold. So he said, look, even if it's a suffix, but you think that you're allowed to determine materials for your community. So the next bold one, on the next page. Do you think that this ruling is valid to the same degree of severity for members of other communities who leaders have not expressly adopted your view and may even rule in the opposite manner? For example, what would you recommend to a disciple of my revered teacher, or Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who resolutely and vigorously asserted there is no prohibition to hand over portions of the land to the nations of the world and there are considerations of saving life, and moreover held that the definition of these considerations must be taken into account the views of military and political leaders. Right? He said, what if someone disagrees with you both halachically and b'mitzius? Right? Thinks that halachically there's no issur, and b'mitzius, rabbis are not meant to make the decision. If someone thinks that from a purely political perspective, the prospects of the evacuation are greater than the dangers, anticipating that it will contribute to saving lives and wishing to participate, relying on Rashba, and even the most pious of the pious are not permitted to do their work by way of trusting God, but only in the manner of the world, do you believe that such a person may be permitted to do so? Right? If someone, meaning, disagrees with you on b'mitzius, do you think they have the right to fight? Or give away the land, rather? I'm aware that you presumably reject this assessment. And I, too, am not convinced that it's correct. But is it obvious? Is it that anyone who adopts it and acts accordingly will not be cleared? Is there no room to clear him, even according to the assumptions of your ruling in line with Rambam? If a person heard that a child drowned at sea and spread a net to rescue him, but he only caught fish, he is exempt from all liability? That is to say, that in cases where a person's actions are motivated by the desire to save life, he can be excused from liability because of the motivation? Or perhaps a distinction must be made between a failure and execution, error, and appraising reality. Then Rav Aharon, and I'll summarize this for you, Rav Aharon then says, I don't understand how you can say Lo Sechanim, because Merkaz is famous for supporting what psak of Rav Kook? Het HaMechira. So, and what was one of the principal critiques raised against Het HaMechira? Lo Sechanim. So Rav Aharon said, you're playing it both ways, right? You're supporting Et HaMechira, and yet you think you can't give away land, which is it? Now, the easy response, which Rav Shechter already defends, you know, this argument 20 years ago, comes up in some form in these letters, is...
It's not permanent,
right? That's the whole point, that it's not permanent, right?
What does it make a difference?
At least potentially makes a difference, right?
Ideologically
definitely makes a difference, but halakhically it might also... Fine, and one's on a national level, and one's on a personal level, the chule.
To be fair, they're using their ideology for the halacha.
Hold that for a minute. Okay. We're going to come back to that, okay? Fine. So then, right, the response by Rav Avraham Silvetsky, this is the grandson-in-law, says, I shall briefly summarize the issues raised by quotes to Aratov. The danger posed by the refusal of orders to the strength and forward to the Israeli army disengagement plans, prospect for success. These factors suffice to forbid refusal of orders and permit the transfer of land to non-Jewish hands. The expression, lo yinakeh, mentioned Mori Zakeini's ruling and its appropriateness in this context, the relationship between the Heter Mechira and giving away land, right, for the parameters of the sanctity of a minor sanctuary. Okay. So, we don't have that much time, so I'm going to summarize it, but you know, you should try to read through some of these. Okay? And what you'll see coming over and over, right, is that there are really two issues going on, which are, right, overlapping. Rav Aaron argues on the halachic arguments, right? Rav Aaron Shapira thinks it's lo sechaneim. He thinks that the way you should interpret the Ramban and Minchas Chinuch is that you're never allowed to give up land because it's not Dochet Pikuach Nefesh under any circumstances. And Rav Aaron challenges that, either because lo sechaneim doesn't apply because it's only to the seven nations, or as Rav Shechter argues, right, maybe even the Ramban. This is not Rav Aaron's argument, it was in Rav Shechter's, right? Maybe even the Ramban would be moda in a losing situation. You could give up land, and then you just have to decide whether it's a losing situation. And consistently, Rav Aaron Shapira takes the very hard line that no, it's really, really usur. And if it's usur, it's straight out usur, then under no circumstance can we engage it. Rav Aaron also makes the argument throughout that telling people to be musarif kuda is itself a pikuach nefesh issue. And Rav Aaron Shapira consistently rejects that and says, look, what guides us is halacha, and if halacha says it's asr, then you're misarif kuda. The fact that the left might be misarif kuda is not our problem, right? They're not allowed to, we are. Right? That's basically the argument that comes out of it.
It sounds to some of you that Rav Aaron is making like meta halachic arguments, like things that are non halachic, completely materialistic arguments. Like,
I mean, Rav Aaron is making the argument. His main argument is you're not right halachically, right? I mean, there's a lot of similarities between Rav Shech and Rav Aaron. He's saying you're not right halachically because even with the Ramban and the Minchas Chinuch, if it was a losing battle, you wouldn't be chayav to give up life, right? Once he doesn't have that halachic argument, his main central thesis is, and you're making a statement, you're making a claim at Metzias, and you don't have the right to do that. Right, those are Aaron's two main points. And Rav Shapira is really arguing on both. One is that halachically I don't think you're right. But even if you were, I don't think you're right in Metzius. Right? And you'll see there's a whole deon, which we won't get into, where Aaron Shapira says, look, it's a Sheva al Tasa Adif. Right? Maybe in theory you would be right. Right? That if it was totally, totally a losing battle, we would do it. Right? But it's Sheva al Tasa Adif, and until you can prove to me that it's in fact going to save lives in the way that you think is halakhically relevant, right? We should not go and give land, which would be a kumvase. Right? And Aaron says, no, that's not true, right? Pikuach nefesh, safik pikuach nefesh is doche. And if you think that it leans on that side, right, then you do have to attempt. But Aaron, right, always doesn't actually make the Matthias argument. He just says that would be true if the Matthias were like that. If you skip down a few pages to the next time I bolded, right. Again, you'll see the sort of the tone of Ravaran's article. First, the awareness of variables and the readiness to take them into account. You tend to include, right, essentially two things are missing. First, the awareness of variables and the readiness to take them into account. You tend to include all uncertainties and risks in one single class as if they were all alike on the same level. Clearly, however, this is not the case. There's no monolithic phenomenon here. When we assess risk, there's no significance to the likelihood of its actualization on the one end and its content on the other. Should we not distinguish between the threat of catching cold and the risk of contracting AIDS and what parallels them on the national level? When defining objectives that may justify risk taking, should we not differentiate between purchasing an apartment and adding a room, and between parallels them on a national level? The sages testify that the returnees from Babel gave up many towns, deliberately not reoccupying them in order to benefit the poor during the sabbatical year. Were they too prepared or permissive to give up the entire idea of reestablishing a kingdom of Israel for the sake of a noble objective? Right here is part of Aaron's halachic argument that not. You do not always have to conquer every part of the land, right? Not an expansive read of Ramban and Michal Skinov. A complex situation is dealt with in a complex manner, and at times in a manner that is also flexible. A situation in which the state of Israel finds itself today is exceedingly complex and complicated. Second element that, to my sovereign surprise, is lacking is the national dimension. Recognition of the government's authority to decide matters, to choose among alternatives, and to assess the state of the country and its opportunities and risks is almost entirely effaced from your letter. You discuss differences of opinion among security experts using tools that are meant to guide halakhic decision-making when disagreements erupt between physicians, and you conclude with a comparison to the Radban's discussion who recommends that it is better to do nothing, shave al-tasa, when doctors disagree about the benefit or harm caused by a particular medicine. Beyond the questions regarding the Radban's position in and of itself, is doing nothing preferable, even the probabilities are not equal, and beyond the question of comparing the risk of murder to that of expropriating property, there emerges an attitude towards your decision of state institution which disregards the government and its status. With great difficulty, you are ready to bestow upon the Prime Minister the status of deciding physician, but does a physician have the authority to decide or is merely a reliable source of information? It is precisely from your school of thought, in light of its past record, meaning the Rav Kook school of thought, that gave halakhic significance to the state, that one might have expected greater emphasis on the national state-oriented dimension. Okay, we're not going to have a chance to read through the rest of it. Read it yourself. But to summarize the issues, and right, you see the tone, both in Rosh Hashanah and Rav Aharon, and to summarize, halakhic issues, right, on the table, right, again to summarize, is in order to say that you absolutely cannot give it bland, right? You have to assume, first of all, that there's a mitzvah, even b'zman hazeh, to conquer Israel, and that is not nidcha mishum pikoach nefesh. Maybe that's even in a losing battle, or not in a losing battle, but this is not a losing battle. If you think the latter, right, that in a losing battle you would be allowed to give a bland l'kulei alma, then you have to make a metzias argument. Rav Shapira basically takes the argument because of Lo Sechaneim, and then later on because of the Minchas Chinuch and the Ramban, you're not allowed to give a bland unless literally you have no choice. He does accept that, right? If it's a losing battle and there's no point, you're allowed to. But that's predicated on a certain metzias. But he thinks, who makes the metzias decision? The rabbis. Right? The rabbis talk to the experts and make their own decisions. Right? Rav Shechter and Rav Aharon, first of all, on the halachic level, think that Rav Aharon's more expansive. Rav Shechter thinks that in a losing situation, defined as a mortal blow to the nation-state, the Ramban would not be true. Rav Aharon questions whether even Lo Sechaneim applies at all, and whether you even need a mortal blow, or you can just trade off different issues. I assume he's not as convinced by the Ramban argument. But both of them agree that if it were going to be a mortal blow, you would be allowed to give up land. What both of them agree to, though, is who makes the decision? Not the rabbis, but the government officials. Rav Shechter specifically thinks that it's the military experts, and if there's no clear-cut military decision, then who makes it? The people, or presumably political bodies. Rav Aharon says who makes the decisions? Primarily the politicians, right? The politicians are in charge, and therefore it's their job to figure out the metzias, right? They obviously have to talk to the military experts, but the responsibility falls with the politicians. So we already talked about last week, right, this split between metzias and halach, and you see it very clearly. We saw it on the private level, and Rav Shechter even connects it to this level, where on the national level now you see that, and the implications of this attitude, that Rav Aharon and Rav Shechter both, following the Rav, think that national decisions have to be made not by rabbis. They argue, they quibble a little bit, is it made by the actual experts, right, the military experts, or is it made by the politicians who are responsible and represent the Amen? They have to figure out the Messiahs. But the same idea holds true. At some level, it's the people who have to make the decision, their representatives, and their experts. Ravram Shapira assumes that, no, really rabbis have right, the authority, and then he makes all the halachic arguments. One last position, very quickly, which I didn't put here, but you can read it. This is a book that the yeshiva put out after Hitnakut. That year, there were a series of sichot in the yeshiva, and they published transcripts of them. So one of them was between Rav Brin and Rav Malamud, which a lot of it revolved around at this point, right? Who gets to make the decision? Rav Brin took the Rav Aharon line, which is, we don't make the Messias claims. Rav Malamud said no. He took the sort of the Merkaz line, that no, the rabbis do. But for Rav Aharon Shapira, why do the rabbis make the Messias decisions, presumably? Doesn't really say, but why do you think? Because that's part of Psak, right? It sounds like that, right? It's just their responsibility to Paskin, and when you Paskin, you have to figure out the Metzias, yes? He actually goes a step farther, and he says, right, you said this before, Yoni, that it seems like they're not just making halakhic arguments, they're making ideological arguments. So he actually says, he accepts that, and embraces it. And he says the reason he thinks that the reason that rabbis in national decisions have to make Metzius arguments is because you can't read Metzius right unless you're biased. Unless you have the proper ideological coloring, right, you won't read Metzius the right way. And only rabbis who understand the value of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael will properly assess whether in fact there's a risk. Right? So he doesn't just say that poskim are responsible to make the halachic Metzius decisions, because at the end of the day, right, for Rav Avraham Shapira, it's the rabbis consulting the military experts, they're just making the decision, but they're not the ones assessing Metzius directly. Rav Malamud actually goes farther and suggests that since all Metzius is biased, right, that would be an argument of Aaron's direction, which is rabbis should stick out of the Metzius. He takes an exact opposite direction and says, no, that's what tells you the rabbis have to be involved, because since all Metzius is biased, the only people who have the right to assess Metzius in complicated situations are the people who have the right ideological orientation and therefore will see the Metzius the correct way. So you see how that same recognition that ideology is often tied up with Metzius can go in two different ways. One is the way I think the Maserah of this yeshiva is to say rabbis don't decide Metzius. The opposite direction is to own it and say no, because Metzius can't be seen without ideology. That is exactly what gives Poskim the responsibility to assess Metzius. So those give you like a few perspectives on the national level of what it means to split Metzius from Psak. We're already a little bit late for Mincha, so we'll stop here.